Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to the first newly recorded episode of Freeform since early 2014. I couldn't resist commenting about the election of Donald Trump and the path forward in confronting him and his administration. And I'll be joined today by Eddie Kurtz, Executive Director of California's Courage Campaign, and Colby Devitt, who's been working on divestment from the banks involved in DAPL, the pipeline opposed by the Standing Rock protests. After hosting and producing this weekly show for 17 years, I stepped away from recording new live interviews, and since then I dig into the archives to stream one of the best of my earlier interviews each week on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts of years of interviews are available to listen to anytime, anywhere, on iTunes and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, TerrenceMcNally.net, or a world that just might work.com. They're the same site. And what I want to start with first is some reflections on the election and where we go moving forward. And then I will bring in Eddie and Colby. So first of all, I walked door to door for Clinton and Senate candidate Catherine Cortez Masto in Las Vegas Monday and Tuesday, the week before the election and the week of the election. And the good news was Hillary took Nevada, and Cortez Masto became the first Latina elected to the Nevada Senate. The bad news, Donald Trump is our next president. Now, at the most basic level, I believe Trump's elections makes life harder for life. That is to say, you know, if you think of nature, if you think of the environment, if you think of humanity, it is harder now. We are going to expend energy and time defending the present that needs to be spent moving forward into the future. And in at least one way, I believe Trump's election is a fate worse than death. With death, the worst has happened. With Trump's election, something unimaginably bad has taken place. But we have every expectation that things are going to get worse, but we don't know when or how. And I think that anxiety and that uncertainty can be debilitating in addition to all the other bad stuff that's happening. It knocks you off your center. Now, I know it's you know, it's almost inauguration. It's closer to the inauguration by far than it is to the election. But let me just, since the first time I've taken to the air, let me tell you a few thoughts I had in digesting it. I think too many people couldn't imagine that Hillary, with Bernie's platform and enthusiastic support, wouldn't be enough. I mean, Bernie's enthusiastic support wouldn't be enough to beat Trump. And because they couldn't conceive, or we couldn't conceive, of Trump's ultimately winning, we and they did not force themselves to be truly strategic about how we confronted his threat. You can't lose on authenticity and emotion and expect to win on experience and policy. Now, we know both candidates weren't liked, but in the exit polls, among those who didn't like either candidate, Trump won 49-29. He spoke directly to people who wanted to be seen and heard. I think this is a critical thing. Hillary Clinton focused much of her campaign and certainly most of her advertising in the closing weeks on telling people they couldn't afford to vote for Trump. It was all anti-Trump, unfit, scare you, all that, rather than the promise of the future. And why didn't that affect people? Why did those folks in the Rust Belt still pull the lever or mark the box for Trump after hearing how horrible he would be? Here's what I think. He aimed his campaign at people who feel they are unseen and unheard. And perhaps he never even knew that early on that he could win. But it didn't matter. So how does a person in that Rust Belt who feels they've been neglected and unheard feel when Hillary's campaign and all of her surrogates start telling her how bad Trump is? Well, here I am. I've got a major political candidate talking to me. And he's not just a nerdy politician. He's a macho, successful, celebrity, billionaire businessman and TV star. And he understands me. He respects me. He cares about me. And you want to base your whole campaign on running him down, telling me he's not good enough to be president? Where have I heard that about not being good enough before? See, and so every time you bang at how unworthy he is and how unfit he is, you play right into that. And it just stiffens their spine to go, hell with you, Hillary. I'm voting for Trump. I will tell you also, one of the scariest things I came across in a few weeks prior to the election was an article in The Guardian, the Guardian out of London, one of the respected progressive newspapers in the world. And it was an article that said, "Junk the System, Why Millennials Aren't Doing What Their Parents Tell Them to Do." And what this person said was that he had come across a lot of millennials who felt that Hillary was just more of the same and that Trump would blow up the system. An argument we've heard elsewhere. His op-ed didn't get me that much. But then I looked at the comments. There were lots of comments, and I'd say 3 out of 4 of them said, "I'm voting for Trump too, for basically the same reason." These were articulate, intelligent readers of The Guardian, and they felt that the change that was needed was so important that it was worth voting in Trump. One of the first commenters who disagreed with them said, "I did the same thing in 68 and wouldn't vote for Humphrey, and that gave us Nixon." Didn't matter. That's when I got really worried. The other thing that I think is the basic problem, and I'm not the first to say it, but I'm just going to try to make the point, is that Hillary was absolutely the wrong candidate for this time, and that she and the Democrats, if they had thought more about the country than about their own political future, would have seen that. Once it became clear that Trump was knocking off 16 rivals, some of them well-practiced, well-groomed, well-financed, the Dems' game plan had to change. Once he became the opponent, they should have realized what his strengths were, who his target audience was, and what his message was: outsider change. He was aiming right at the Rust Belt states. The Dems had to defense that, but they also had to respect it. They had an opportunity, and this, I think, is one of the saddest things about the Democrats in this election and the Democratic Party moving forward. They had the opportunity to live up to their claims of standing for the little guy and fighting for the middle class by nominating Bernie Sanders, who authentically does that. He was going to win the Latino, the Black, the Asian votes, if not as convincingly as Hillary. He was going to win them. And he was going to win and energize the young. Who could add the most whites? Bernie by far, because he would add a lot of those whites that went across and voted for Trump. He was the most liked politician versus the least liked. Hillary, with the Goldman Sachs speeches, mattered much more to people than Trump's tax returns. And just because Hillary and her people could explain the fact that she was not liked or trusted to a vast right-wing conspiracy over 30 years doesn't change the fact that that's the way people felt. The fact that you can say, "But wait, it's just because they said so," doesn't matter. All those people that couldn't stand her still couldn't stand her, even if she said it's because they did it. And so what we had was a chance for the Democrats to nominate someone who truly represented what they say they represent. And what we would be talking about right now, and I probably still couldn't resist the chance to get on the air to talk about it, would be what happens in a Bernie Sanders presidency. But instead, we're standing here with, as we find out more about the Russian hand in this, as we find out, the Congress, by the way, has already passed the RAINS Act. For any of you who missed that this week, the House has passed it. It will go to the Senate. The RAINS Act basically says any regulation put forward by the executive branch, that means the Education Department, the House and Human and Social Services, every environmental regulation, if it is not approved by the Congress within 70 days, it does not take effect. What does that mean? That means that you have scientific study goes on for years. They come up with a regulation that's based on important information, as I say, years of experts figuring this out, and they put it out there. And if the Republican-led Congress decides they don't want to okay it, they just ignore it, or they can hold hearings. And what would that be? That would be a bunch of congressmen and senators who don't know a thing relative to what these experts know, having stupid hearings and then not voting for it. And anything that doesn't get voted for won't get passed. This is a radical change in the way, the role of government. Is government going to safeguard and protect us? Is government going to pave the way to the future? Not with the RAINS bill. Let me just say one last thing. Ohio and Michigan are two of the states we consider responsible for electing Trump. Now, Obama bailed out the auto industry at significant political costs, most directly from free market Republicans who were against it and who they voted for. In doing so, he saved a potential 340,000 jobs in Michigan, more than 200,000 in Ohio, almost 50,000 in Pennsylvania, and close to 45,000 in Wisconsin. He also added 640,000 jobs to a revived American auto industry. And that doesn't count the tens of thousands of jobs that would have been lost by parts suppliers and so on. And without Obama's bailout, Midwestern workers would have been vulnerable to even further job loss by foreign competition. And did the Clinton campaign repeat this endlessly? I don't know. But it seems to me if that was on TV and on everyone's mouth, everyone's lips, from the start of the campaign till Election Day, the results in those states might have been different. One thought that I had, actually, one op-ed I came across on the 18th of November said, it's time to consider progressive secession. This was by Pascal Zachary, an alternate on 1118. And boy, when I read it, I knew it was impossible. Secession, we seceded from the British, and the South tried to secede from the North, and both times it's war. But imagine if there were a country that had the ethics, the morals, and the politics of California, Oregon, and Washington. That would be a country I'd be proud to be part of. So where do we go forward? The harsh and unexpected reality, I hope, incites people to be more bold in significant numbers and with transformative results than they've been thinking, even with Bush and Cheney in power. It wasn't this kind of a horror. And if that happens, then it'll be that thing that you don't change until you hit bottom and you don't go bold until you are cornered. That is my hope, that personally as a society, we actually make that turn. Now, on the current playing field of electoral politics and institutions of government, we're powerless on a federal level. The GOP has Senate, House, presidency, all the agencies, the Supreme Court, and the military. And it turns out, obviously, they have the FBI as well. So we have to act with greater boldness in California, and that's what I'll talk about with Eddie Kurtz, and we have to, on a national basis, offer a bold model of what the difference is. Think of it as Governor Jerry Brown versus Governor Sam Brownback of Kansas, and look at the results. We don't have to win all of the Rust Belt, just a few thousand votes here and there. And we have to mobilize for 2018 like nobody's business. We stand prepared to shift the playing field to the streets or to large rallies and mass demonstrations, whatever it takes to make that change. And I myself, I'm going to lay this out here now, so that Eddie can comment it and Colby can comment on it, which is that I believe that what we need is a overarching umbrella organization that pulls together all the other activism across generations and across geography. Now, I've been calling it, as I've been thinking about it and talking about it, 60s 2.0, because it's this notion, what if we could bring the best of the 60s to life in 2017, only this time young people have the technology to realize their vision, and boomers have more time, money, and experience than they've ever had, and add to them the millions of like-minded members of the generations in between. We must respond to Trump's election and the dominance of Washington by a party committed to disabling and postponing social and environmental progress, and we must settle for nothing less than ultimately, finally turning things around. Because if we blow it on inequality, we lose the middle class. We blow it on health care, we can bankrupt the country. We blow it on climate change, and we can take down the entire civilization. We need to act boldly. It's time for a national movement that brings together individuals and organizations, as I said, across issues, geography, generations, color, and class, organized, this is my thought, around a handful of declared goals on climate, inequality, civil rights, jobs, education, perhaps healthcare, perhaps national security. And then, with all these different groups and generations dedicated to supporting each other with funding, strategy, organizing, communication, street actions, to achieve the shared goals, and in doing so, transform the country and save the world. And if such a movement exists, and I just haven't heard about it, I want to join it. And if it doesn't, I want to help it emerge. Now, let's turn to what is happening now, what is happening in response to the election, and I'm going to give you a few organizations that I know are doing some very valuable stuff. Hold on one second. Indivisible is one. Indivisible, I believe it's a group of former congressional staffers. You can go to indivisibleguide.com. Their Twitter is at indivisibleteam, and their Facebook is Indivisible Guide. They have put out an Indivisible Guide for resisting Donald Trump, and they did an op-ed in the New York Times on the 2nd of January that said, to stop Trump, Democrats can learn from the Tea Party. And they've gotten a big response. So that's one organization that I would definitely say. And then in terms of – and on climate, I would say 350.org, the organization that has been so wonderful for years, organizing a divestment from fossil fuels movement and then confronting both at Standing Rock and successfully confronting on the XL pipeline. Now, many people participate, but 350 has really taken the lead in a lot of those things. The two sort of national figures, or I will say three national figures that make that four, that I think are worth following are Robert Reich, robertreich.org, and Twitter is at rbreich. Michael Moore, facebook.com/mmflint. Obama. It'll be interesting to see what Obama does once he's out of office. And then, of course, Bernie Sanders and Our Future and Elizabeth Warren. And I think that's the people to plug into nationally. And if you email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, I will send you all of that information, those links, those organizations. A few days after the election, I sat in on a phone call put on by the Courage campaign, and I felt it was just days after, and I said, these people are doing effective things. And the first person I thought of asking to join me today is Eddie Kurtz, Executive Director of the Courage Campaign. And Eddie, welcome.
Thanks, Sarah. It's great to be here.
And my first question is, I've given your title. Tell us just a bit. I like people to get a feeling for who we're talking to. Tell us just a little bit about your path to heading up the Courage campaign.
Sure. I'd be happy to. I was actually originally educated as a theater director. I moved out to California to work at the Berkeley Repertory Theater, and I worked as an apprentice director there under Tony Ticone, and we took a show to Broadway, among other things. And then the Iraq War happened, and I got politicized, and I took a journey, did a Coro Fellowship along the way, did a number of things, and I joined Courage Campaign about 5 years ago, initially running campaigns. And 2 years ago became the executive director.
The Courage campaign has also gone through an evolution. Would you describe that?
Absolutely, yeah. Courage Campaign was founded a little over 10 years ago, and it was founded as a multi-issue organization, basically the idea being it would be the moveon.org of California, basically using digital tools in California to enact change, you know, online petitions, social media, that kind of thing, although social media was still pretty new 10 years ago. And over time, you know, Courage Campaign went through a major shift around Prop 8. When Prop 8 passed in particular, it was a huge moment. A moment in some ways that has some parallels to right now, where there was such shock, where people were so horrified that this could happen in California, that there was a moment of engagement. And Courage Campaign really took a leading role in the fight against Prop 8, particularly once it had passed, although we were involved in their fight against it when it was on the ballot, too. And for a couple of years, Courage Campaign was really defined by its active marriage equality as an issue, and by far most of our work was around marriage equality. And then as that began to recede, and we began to have major victories on the national level on that, we kind of have gone back to our roots over the last couple of years, and I've been, leading that transition back to really focusing on a broad array of progressive issues through the lens of California.
Very good. I must say that that comment you made about the passage of Prop 8 actually invigorated people. It's that thing I talked about earlier you kind of know you should be involved, but you're able not to because someone else is going to take care of it. And then it gets so bad you say, I've got to get involved. Another meeting that I went to soon after the election, a woman spoke up, and a Latino woman, I'd say in her late 20s, early 30s, and she said the last time that she had felt as she did on the morning of November 9th, 2016, was in 1994, when Prop 187 passed in California, an anti-immigrant legislation in California. And she said, I just felt, you know, the world had broken. She said, but look at us now. We are the bluest state in the country. We are the model for immigration. We're the model for climate change, et cetera, et cetera. We have 2/3 majorities, Democrats in both houses, et cetera, et cetera. We do the hard work of, you know, passing tax increases if they're needed and everything works. And she said, we got to remember that when we feel bleak.
I think that's, that really resonates with me as well. And I think there's different people have their moment, you know, I think there are a lot of parallels between what happened in California in the 90s and what's happening with Trump nationally right now.
Yeah. So we have to hope that it means that people have both the will and the stamina, because we're talking about both with Prop 8 and with 187 years have gone by, that it was step by step to get where we are today. But we have to hope that same thing can happen on the national level. What has been the Courage campaign's response so far to the new administration?
Absolutely. So when the election happened, and we were as shocked as anyone. I mean, we, you know, I read the same polls that everyone else did. I was as deeply upset, and I had tried to envision this prior to the election, and there was just, I just couldn't. I was frustrated by that, but I just couldn't imagine it, and here we are, you know. And so immediately after, you know, we were in shock, and we wrote, it took a couple days and some tears and some really rigorous thinking, but we composed a message to our 1.3 million members articulating what we've come to call the courageous resistance. This resistance to Trump and just, you know, the Republican extreme right-wing policies overall. And what that did is that articulated three goals, which we think are all critical these days. And those are, number one, to protect our communities in whatever peaceful way we can, and that is, you know, frontline communities, immigrants, Muslim people, women to a certain degree, just in general, protecting those who are going to come under increasing threat. I have to make it clear that some of these groups are very much under threat, even under an Obama administration, but to particularly do all we can to protect them. The second goal was to demand courageous leadership, particularly by Democrats in Congress. So, you know, we do not want a repeat of what happened in many of the Bush years, where Democrats rolled over and things like the Iraq War. And so that being the second goal. And then third, and then this resonates, I think, a lot with what you were saying earlier about California as this potential model, or the West Coast, you know, as a model of progressive governance. You know, I think it's a genuine question, after this election, whether, you know, progressive governance of a diverse, multicultural society is possible. I mean, I think the answer is yes, it is possible, but when you see what happened to our nation and how resentments and racism and many other isms were used to have people vote against their best interests to fall for this con man. I think it's a genuine question that California must answer affirmatively. Like, yes, this is possible. We are doing it. We are actually governing in a way that benefits everyone, that creates opportunity for everyone across the board, meritocracy in the best of ways. And so that's, you know, that's the third part. It's like pushing back against Trump and the Republicans, it can only go so far. We have to also model the solutions. And those are the three goals we articulated.
I'm Terrence McNally. This is Free Forum, and I'm speaking with Eddie Kurtz, President and Executive Director of the Courage Campaign. Let me tell you one thing you reminded me there when I look at number 2 and 3, demanding courageous leadership, and then your question in number 3, is it possible to actually do what we say we think should be done? That is to say, effectively act on climate change, effectively battle inequality, effectively protect communities and have a diverse and open society. And let me say that I think that they go together this way. The Democrats, in under Clinton, I think especially, lost their way and began to reach out to the big donors, the same donors that support the Republican Party. And the problem is that when the Republican Party acts on behalf of those donors, they are in sync. They've raised their money from Wall Street. Their goals are Wall Street, and so they can go for touchdowns. And America loves that. The Democrats in power under Clinton and under Obama, they have taken money from Wall Street, huge gobs of it. They've become very friendly with Wall Street. Look at who Obama put in to right the ship after the economic crisis. And so, although they say that their principles are for the middle class, the working people, the union people, and so on, they end up splitting the difference. They actually don't try to score touchdowns. They go to like the 20-yard line and say that's enough. And America can see that. And so even if you question someone's policies, if you feel like they have conviction and courage of their convictions, that is attractive. And the Democrats have undercut themselves. So when you finally, what is saddest to me is that we couldn't have reversed that without this horrible outcome. That Bush and Cheney wasn't enough of a message of what happens when you don't actually live up to your convictions. And I will say one thing. I looked back at the past 50 years or so, and there was a period where the Democrats, it began to happen under John Kennedy. Martin Luther King was a leader who spoke to these things. Robert Kennedy had become someone who spoke to these things and so on. And what happened? They were assassinated. When you assassinate the charismatic leaders of a movement, you then create this huge gap. And as we see with Clinton, as we see with Obama, as we see with Trump, charisma wins elections. You take out the charismatic leaders who lean one way, you leave us where a charismatic Bill Clinton is the best we have to offer. And that, I think, is what has ultimately, I think I can see a link between those assassinations and Trump's election. I know I went off there. Any thoughts, Eddie?
Yeah, well, I agree with everything you said. I mean, the elites are running this country, and they're elites of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and they are in bed with major corporations and doing their bidding. If you look at what the bipartisan consensus is in Washington, there is a bipartisan consensus. In fact, you know, it's around things like the TPP and this idea of increasing corporate profits in any number of ways. And so I could not agree with you more. I do think if you look at the last, I don't know, you know, 30, 40 years, the more charismatic candidate has pretty much always won an election. Be it Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton or Barack Obama or Donald Trump. It's pretty startling, and just this fact that human beings we're animals. You know, we respond we're not super intellectual in a lot of these things and these deeper decisions that we make. We respond in ways that are more animalistic and more subconscious. And I think, you know, Donald Trump spoke to a lot of that, and absolutely it's that old Paul Wellstone line, you know, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And we have to revive that. We have to, through modern folks like you're mentioning, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, there's a big fight around that in California, which I imagine we'll be getting to, but that is, you know, for all the good going on in California, that is a major fight, that is very much underway here.
Well, speak to that.
Well, you know, in California, we have, you know, Democratic Party and all these super majorities, and we have made real progress here. But if you've been following fights closely over the last couple of years, you'll know that there are a lot of fights we haven't been winning. The fracking fight, in particular, is one that stands out. The fight for real, you know, racial justice. The fight to reform our tax code to really, you know, a broad-based tax code that raises all boats. We've made some important improvements, but there are major issues going on in California. And California, after all, we can't forget this, California has the highest poverty rate in the nation when you account for cost of living.
Right.
So there are a lot of folks in California that are hurting deeply, very badly, and the government has not been serving them particularly well. And a lot of that has to do with Democrats who don't vote like Democrats, who
That's
take
right.
lots of money from corporations and then vote in their interests in Sacramento. And what Courage Campaign, my organization, often focuses energy on is exposing those Democrats who often represent deep blue parts of the state in the the Los Angeles area, in the Bay Area, and then other, you know, and others, who simply, you know, their constituents would be horrified if they learned what they were really up to. Courage Campaign has done a number of things, including the People's Report Card of California, which you can find at couragescore.org, which tried to expose some of these Democrats. And it was no coincidence that last year we made a lot of progress on climate change legislation, on overtime for farm workers, and other things that had been stalled previously thanks to some exposing of these corporate ties. But that being said, and I must add that the top two primary plays a major role in this, whereas often now, you know, two candidates from the same party will face off not just in the primary, but they will face off in the general election thanks to a proposition we passed a few years ago. And what that has done is it has opened the floodgates for corporations to fund one Democrat over another, and inevitably that's the more corporate Democrat. And in those level races, when you're talking about a state Senate or a state assembly race, money makes an enormous difference, because there's just so information, voters have such little information about the candidates. So there are fights there, and we have been engaged, and I can go on and on about it, but there are some major fights in California that we have to engage on, and we have to prove this model of progressive governance works. And the same threats to the National Democratic Party, the same things you're articulating, you know, Bill Clinton and neoliberalism and all this, those are very much alive and well, those fights in California. And I hope, as part of the courageous resistance, which I'd love to talk about too, those fights are very much on the menu.
Very good. I will ask you to talk about the courageous resistance, and I'll do it with two intro questions, which is what that first meeting I went to was within a week or two after the election?
I think it was right before Thanksgiving, I believe. Yeah. So it was like the week.
Yeah.
We mobilized fast, and it was frankly pretty hard to pull off, but we're really glad we did.
Yeah. So what have you learned since then? What has surprised you since then? And what is the courageous resistance up to now?
So we articulated these goals, and you know, we have primarily in the past been grassroots organizers who work online, who use online digital tools, and we just know that that's not enough anymore. It was never enough. There are a lot of really wonderful uses of digital tools. You can reach, you know, people in a scale that just was never possible before, and that's wonderful. But if you don't combine that with the offline, the neighbor-to-neighbor organizing, the people in community with one another, after all, again, we're human beings. We're social animals, and we need that. And in politics, you need boots on the ground to exercise real political power, and that's something that 350.org and the other folks you were mentioning, you know, with the pipeline, the North Dakota Access Pipeline, you know, they showed so powerfully, is if you, you know, you need to organize offline as well to have power. And that's really the major shift the Courage Campaign is making with the courageous resistance. And to your question about what we've learned, well, so we had about 2,000 people RSVP for that call that you were on, which Senator Kevin DeLeon joined to articulate some of his goals, and we also, you know, outlined the goals of the courageous resistance. And since then, those 2,000 people have organized over 80 emergency community meetings all over California, where they have opened their homes or their place of work to their neighbors. And just, you know, there are people coming out of the woodwork, you know, like we were talking about, you know, post Prop 8, where people who were sitting on the sidelines and assuming someone else was going to take care of this stuff, this democracy stuff, those people are now looking, they're saying, okay, I guess I have to take it to the next level. What do I do? And so we're trying to be a vessel for those people, and to provide the organizing infrastructure. If you want to host an event at your home, we're trying to provide, you know, curriculum or best practices so you can do it in the best way possible. So we've had all those meetings, and then we've also, our organizers have been in communication with the folks who hosted those meetings, and we've sent surveys to our members, to try to have them articulate what their priorities are in this time. And we have learned that people are, there were two major things that our survey came back and showed. Is that, you know, within California, there is major energy to protect frontline communities, that protecting, you know, immigrants, people of color, the Muslim community, women to a degree, that there is major energy. That is number one priority for people. The second priority that was articulated was about around healthcare. And protecting the good parts of the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare, but also filling in those places where it's failed. And of course, if they repeal it, things will get even worse. On a national level, our folks really want to engage in the cabinet fights, you know, in these nomination fights. So those are the things that we've learned. We've learned just that our members are incredible. There is so much energy out there, and we're trying to harness that energy, and we're trying to provide strategic guidance to our members to really take their activism to the next level and enact, I mean, to what you were talking about before, and you had asked for comment on this idea of an umbrella organization to really lead this you know, hopefully a new wave of activism that connects to the 60s and maybe is possible to achieve some of the things that weren't possible then. You know, we want to be very much a part of that. I don't know if anyone wants to, other organizations want to become part of Courage Campaign, but we are very much open to partnering with other organizations and trying to, you know, break down the barriers and the silos that often exist in the progressive movement, and welcoming all comers, saying, hey, if you want to be part of the solution, we want to work with you.
Okay, let me go right to this question. Eddie Kurtz, Executive Director of the Courage Campaign. What are some of the organizations you're working with? I know one of the people that was on that call was from California Calls, which is a grassroots organization. But what are some of the others that you have found yourself partnering with or aligning with?
Absolutely. So Courage Campaign actually hosts something called the California Progressive Convening 4 times a year. And what that is it's been an attempt to get progressive organizations from across the state in the same room to talk about strategy and movement building and to try to get on the same page as much as possible. And so, you know, we had one of those shortly after the election, and all of the major labor organizations were there, and we're in constant communication with them. So you're talking about the SEIU State Council, AFSCME, the two teacher unions, CFT and CTA, and so those you know, powerful organizations. At times, I would say, as the progressive movement, you know, we work hand in hand with them, and then other times, maybe we find ourselves a little frustrated when they're not as much connected to the movement. In California Calls, as you mentioned, it's a statewide grassroots organizing group that specializes in neighbor-to-neighbor contact, and they have been, you know, critical in recent victories, like passing Prop 55 this year, the extension of taxes on the wealthy. Other groups that are in that room include the ACLU, Planned Parenthood, and community groups in certain areas of the state. So we really cast a very broad net, and have been actively trying to you know, engage with anyone who wants to, and that includes the biggest organizations in the state.
What about nationally?
Nationally, you know, there's this narrative that's emerged that, frankly, I think is right, that California is sort of the home of the resistance. You know, and that California not only needs to be this model, but needs to, you know, be the first one fighting back, in some ways similar to the way Texas fought back against the Obama administration. And so there are a number of opportunities for California and people across the nation to exert influence. I think this last week, this vote, you know, the Office of Congressional Ethics, the Republicans revealed that we've seen this in a number of ways. They will overreach. They are already overreaching with these disgusting, unimaginable cabinet nominations that are deeply out of touch, even with Trump voters. And so there's opportunity. You know, Dianne Feinstein, California Senator, is the ranking member on the Judiciary Committee. So, you know, hopefully, with us behind her, you know, she will give Jeff Sessions a hell of a ride. And of course, you know, when it comes to Supreme Court nomination time, there's also, you know, California sends more Republicans to Congress than any state other than Texas. There are tons of Republican Congress people from California. And, you know, if you look at reports that came out this last week, the folks who are actually on Medi-Cal, which is California's version of Medicaid, you know, health care for the poor, that there are tremendous numbers of those in those Republican districts, in Tulare County, in Merced County, in those parts of the state. So if we do our job, grassroots organizing, and organize people in those counties to hold their elected representatives accountable, it's untenable. It's untenable for Kevin McCarthy in Bakersfield to really gut Obamacare because he's screwing over his own constituents. And we can make that land, and hopefully there's an opportunity there. We're already seeing disarray around taking apart the Affordable Care Act, and hopefully we can lean into that and really make the Republicans wear this, make them face the full consequences of what they're trying to do.
So what I didn't hear in that answer, Eddie, is there a national movement similar to what Courage Campaign is to California. As you've been talking to people and reaching out to people, do you know where it is, where it's founding, where it's starting, or does it not yet exist?
You know, there are a number of groups that seem to be on a similar page to us. You know, one being the Working Families Party, which is particularly active out east. You know, they are an alternative to the Democratic Party in
New York, sure.
Connecticut, and a number of northeastern states. They are very much on the same page that we are. Our good friends at MoveOn.org, I haven't talked to Anna Gowan, their ED, recently, but I know, you know, I don't know if they have the same offline emphasis which Working Families Party does. But you know, there's definitely a lot of alignment there. So, you know, I don't think there's no simple answer at this point. There's a lot of groups. Some of them doing really good work, some of them doing pretty good work, you know, a few doing bad work. But there's, I think it's still, there's still a lot of sorting out that will happen.
Okay, and finally, Eddie Kurtz, where can listeners learn more? What are the websites, the Facebook pages, the apps, and so on, where they can plug in?
Absolutely. You can come to couragecampaign.org. That's our website, and there should be a pop-up as soon as you land. You can join our email list and go from there. On Facebook, we're at Courage Campaign. Same on Twitter, at Courage Campaign. If you're curious for what I mentioned about the scores of California representatives, state-level representatives, you can go to couragescore.org.
Okay, very good. I'm going to let you go. The website, again, Eddie just gave you, couragecampaign.org. Eddie Kurtz, President and Executive Director of the Courage Campaign. Thank you. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Terrence.
I'm Terrence McNally. You're listening to Free Forum, the first live new Free Forum in more than 2 years. And my next guest on the same topic, basically, is Colby Devitt. Colby, I'm going to do the same thing with you that I did with Eddie, which is that I know that you work with Devitt and Perlman, a digital marketing agency, and that you got very involved with Standing Rock and have had a number of articles published in Yes Magazine and on the Bill Moyers website about the divestment movement. Can you tell a little bit about your path to this moment?
Sure, sure. My path to this moment was I started as a concerned citizen who is deeply engaged with and caring for environmental issues, particularly getting us off fossil fuels and onto clean energy. And I, like many people, was moved by the injustices and the environmental racism against the Standing Rock Sioux. Then, on top of that, I decided to go to Standing Rock because they were calling for, at that time, three particular types of people. People who would be willing to winterize the camp and provide manual labor, people who are willing to be arrested, and people who had social media skills who could use them to help amplify their message. And this was at a time before the mainstream media basically went there. So I said, hey, I can be of use. So I went there and had the very good fortune of arriving at Standing Rock the day after the presidential election. And that really changed my perspectives in many ways, because instead of sitting on my couch, wallowing in despair, complaining on social media, railing at the TV, I was immediately thrust into action and channeled my energy into doing something constructive and was welcomed by a culture of Lakota there who have had a 500-year history of fighting against genocide. And some of those people there were like, Trump, yeah, he's bad, but Andrew Jackson, he was pretty bad too.
And perspective.
Yeah. And so I was deeply moved by my experience there. I spent a week and I was surprised. Well, I wasn't really surprised, but it was still staggering to see the level of injustice being done there, the militarization of the police force, the private mercenaries who were there. We were under constant surveillance. I was there as media, and they were targeting media and medics on the front lines. And so I did have an instance where, well, I had several instances where my video was shut down, and I did file my case with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And so to see planes flying overhead, where it was a restricted airspace where they shouldn't have been doing that. Many of the injustices that have been reported in the press at this point was surprising. But even more surprising than that was a lesser told story of peace. And I was really impressed by the strength of the nonviolence training that we were given and the movement that was going on there. And there were people, speaking of your idea to unify the movement of the 60s with the present day, there were people there who had been active in the civil rights movement, professional nonviolent protesters who'd been in the movement for 40 years, who said that they hadn't seen such a strong nonviolent culture since the 60s. And the untold story, in my opinion, is that there had been people there since April who had been going out on daily actions. They were called actions to go to the front line, which is right, you know, meters away, and to face police and law enforcement officials in full riot gear. And it's scary, right? So they're training you to overcome your fight or flight instinct, to stick together, to do what you need to do.
Quickly, let me break in. Mm-hmm. When you say the fight or flight instinct, we all sort of go, oh, yeah, yeah. But in this case, that's really important. It's not only that you don't fly, it's that you don't fight.
Correct. And it's one thing to know that in abstract. It's another thing to be prepared for it and to have the number of the legal team written on your arm to make sure that's who you're going to call, to know what the protocol is. And there are people there on the lines when going peaceful, stay calm, know what you're there for. Before you would go out on the front lines, there was always a ceremony. There was a water ceremony in the mornings, and there are 7 Lakota values that they taught you and they wanted you to abide by. It was a sober camp. No drugs or alcohol allowed. It was a sacred camp. So the juxtaposition of both being in what that was referred to as a war zone and being in a sacred space was amazing. And so the strength of staying in those values and staying nonviolent and the untold story is all of those actions that had occurred since April. And you know that if there had been some yahoo on the side of the water protectors who had acted out and acted stupidly, that would have been reported. And there, you don't hear that because it didn't happen, because of the magnificence and the dedication and the commitment to that strength of that nonviolence. So that is something that certainly has stayed with me and certainly has motivated me. And what Eddie was saying about the need to have boots on the ground and to have a real offline presence as well as an online presence, I wholeheartedly agree with. And as a professional who has been a digital marketer and a social media marketer who is paid to build up digital networks and campaigns and tell stories across social media for a multiplicity of clients, I know well the power of the online world and the ability to manipulate public opinion via story. But I know the even greater power when you marry that with offline real world action. So that is something that people at Standing Rock did so, so brilliantly. And I'm one example of being very moved by that culture there and coming back and going, well, I can do more. And in fact, because of the lack of internet access, the signal jamming, the inability to really get, well, the difficulty, not the inability, but the difficulty of getting stories out there, posting them from the field out there, I knew that I could offer some more help when I got back. So one of the things that I did is I started a daily dose of No Dapple, where I put out a informal social media newsletter, basically, across Facebook and Twitter. And the goal was to amplify the voices, particularly the indigenous voices coming out of the camps to a wider audience. And so I did that for about a month. And along the way, as I was tweeting incessantly, I along with many people went, well, where's this going? What are we doing? What are we doing next? And the call to divest and to figure out how to bring this pipeline company to its knees, and then to look at the many other pipelines that are being built and the indigenous communities that are being affected, and what do we do about those? And so, well, one of the things is in my daily dose of No Dapple, I put out links to not only what was happening at the camps on a daily basis, but what we could do about it. And so Hugh McMillan of Food and Water Watch created a very helpful chart illustrating the 17 banks that are invested in DAPL. And so that was published in a very helpful article by Yes Magazine. And I was linking to that regularly. And I was linking to some of their other articles on divestment regularly. And so I had a follower on Twitter say, hey, well, if we close our bank accounts, how do we do that most effectively? What do we do? So I tweeted at Yes, and I said, hey, could you write an article like that? And they said, yes. Hey, could you write that article?
Yeah.
So I said, yes, I can. And so there were yeses all around. And so I wrote that article. It got some traction. And then as the defund DAPL movement was growing, my interest in divestment was growing specifically around this pipeline, I started to dig deeper and go, well, what are the divestment strategies that are really going to work?
And let me just say for a second, divestment, if people remember, divestment not so much from banks but from in corporations and boycotts and so on, were successful in ending apartheid.
Correct.
But there hasn't been, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, 350.org has advocated for divestment from get your university not to invest in, get their pension fund not to invest, et cetera, et cetera. And other thing, Kobe says the word DAPL. That is the acronym for the pipeline that
Dakota
we are attempting.
Dakota Access Pipeline.
Yeah.
It's the Dakota
so
Access
what you discovered about divestment?
What I did is I started to interview the people who've been really committed to it in the field in this area. And there are three types of divestment that people are focused on. One is the personal divestment, closing your bank account. The other is to get financial institutions to or large organizations, pensions to get rid of their stocks and bonds. And then the other one is the largest one is really to get banks to cancel their lines of credit, their credit loans. So all the divestment movement is challenging on all three fronts. And to some extent, and I'm in the middle of researching this now and want to do more articles on it. To some extent, getting a bank to cancel their line of credit is the big ticket, right? However, getting individuals to cancel their bank, move their money into a bank like Amalgamated Bank, which is, I believe, the only bank that has fully committed to, is fully divested of fossil fuels. And there are a handful of other good banks and there are credit unions that you can move your money to. But having people on the ground protesting works. And one example of that is, again, this came from my activity on Twitter, is I had come back from Standing Rock and I saw that there was this banker who from Sweden who was at Standing Rock. And I went, well, that's interesting. I'm in the middle of researching my next piece. Hey, can I talk to you? And he said, yes. And it turns out that he was the head of sustainable finance for Nordea, which is the largest Nordic bank. And he was there to do his due diligence for his bank. And then the next week, Nordea made an announcement that they have decided that if the pipeline company does not reroute around the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, they will withdraw their holdings from ETP Energy Transfer Partners and some of the other parent companies that are invested in the Dakota Access Pipeline. So that was significant. And so one of the things I learned in this is that there are many Well, to back up, one thing that was really inspiring about the Standing Rock Sioux movement and being there was the diversity of allies that they invited in, the guests that they allowed on their land. And that idea of enlisting the environmentalists as allies, keeping it an indigenous-centered movement, because that's what it is, and then working with diverse groups to help grow was a very powerful move on their part and very powerful emotionally. And one of the things I think would be really great moving forward is for the environmental movement to continue to reach out to the financial institutions who are favorable to divesting and moving away from fossil fuel and to clean energy. And Sasha Beslick, the head of sustainable finance, is one of those people, and his bank was influenced to have him come to Standing Rock by the Sami, by the indigenous tribes, people in Sweden, who through Greenpeace, in coordination with Greenpeace, delivered a message while they were protesting to the bank in Sweden, at their headquarters in Sweden.
Thank you, Colby, for giving us a sense of what it was like to be there, as well as the strategy you've been working on. Where can listeners learn more? What are the websites, Facebook pages, etc.? One is obviously Yes Magazine, and that is yesmagazine.org, mm-hmm. where you'll find Colby's articles. And for those of you, over the years, I've often referred to Yes articles and so on, but it is a place that collects good news, not fluff, but good news, hard-won good news.
Mm-hmm. Another place to go to is standwithstandingrock.net, which is the Standing Rock Sioux Tribes organization.
Standwithstandingrock.net.
Correct. And then there are two major camps that have websites. One is Ocheti Shekowin Camp. That's going to be a hard one to pronounce. Okay. Sacred Stone Camp. Sacred
Much
Stone
easier.
Camp is another one. They're both on Facebook, and you can find them there. SacredStoneCamp.org, I believe, is that one. Oh, Defund DAPL. Do Defund DAPL.
That's Defund and then DAPL. Defund, DAPL.
.org. And 350.org, whom you've referenced, they also have a page on Standing Rock.
Okay. And as I said before, email me at temcnally@mac.com, and I will give you all of these websites and links. There, we have a great deal of work to do, and luckily, there are a great deal of people taking on this work. I've got to pull this to a close. My thanks to our earlier guest, Eddie Kurtz, the executive director of the Courage Campaign. Thank you, Colby Devitt. Keep up the good work. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Freeform Podcast on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. I look forward to being with you again. Thank you.